What's happening, friends? Welcome back to the Bitcoin Builders Weekly Breakdown. This is the Bitcoin Builders show where we break down the most important news and discussions from across the Bitcoin landscape. Bitcoin Builders is, of course, brought to you by In Wolf's Clothing, Wolf, the first startup accelerator focused on Lightning. In this episode, we discuss some Lightning news, a Bitcoin real estate startup, and Russia getting into mining. It's Friday, April 21st. This is Bitcoin Builders. Let's go. All right, back with another Bitcoin Weekly Breakdown. Now, broadly speaking, this week, some of the biggest background noise was regulatory. And really, there was a stark contrast drawn between the US and Europe. In Europe, we had the Markets in Crypto Assets, or MiCA, legislation passed, which is really a comprehensive framework for a number of different parts of the crypto industry. But back over here in the United States, the US House Financial Services Committee in Congress held not one, but two hearings on crypto. One was about stablecoins and the newly reintroduced stablecoin bill that would try to set common sense rules for the road for that segment of the industry. And the other was a House oversight hearing for the SEC. That was really a chance for House Republicans to grill SEC Chair Gary Gensler about his policies of regulation by enforcement and to try to get a straight answer out of him around things like whether Ethereum was a security or not. Representative Patrick McHenry tried to use Bitcoin as a counterpoint, saying that Gary had been comfortable saying that Bitcoin was a commodity, but Gary just fell back on saying that previous SECs had already decided that it was. Still, Bitcoin, by and large, did not care about any of that. From a market's perspective, Bitcoin had been hanging around the 30K mark for some time now. If you listen to my episode with James Check from Glassnode at the end of last week, you'll hear why that rally up over 30,000 seems to have been driven by good old-fashioned spot buying rather than by leverage trading. However, on Wednesday, early morning Europe time, late night Tuesday in America, Bitcoin saw a massive red candle, sliding 3% in just 15 minutes and then continuing down to 29,000. By yesterday, we were hovering around 28,000. Now, sometimes there are strong narratives around moves, but not so much on this one. A few outlets tried to point to an unexpectedly high UK inflation reading for March as a culprit, but it seems sort of suspect to me. There may have been a bit more to see in market structure. There was a pretty massive sell order on Binance preceding the move. 16,000 Bitcoin worth $476 million at the time were set for sale all at once. As 52K Skew tweeted, 16K Bitcoin is unusual size to be market sold solely from Binance spot. Usually that kind of sale happens before bad news comes out. On the move down, 25 million in Bitcoin futures were liquidated, and of those, 98% were longs. Binance open interest fell 5.1% in 15 minutes. Still, this wasn't a move that really had anyone freaked out at all. In fact, for many, Bitcoin sentiment was better reflected in a report from Wall Street research firm Bernstein. The report argued that Bitcoin is in for its biggest bull run ever, making the case for it as a hedge against potential recession and the debasement of the US dollar. The report effectively says that markets are sleeping on Bitcoin. Quote, despite Bitcoin being the best performing asset this year, up approximately 71% year to date, editors note it's more like 80% now, there is limited belief that this is structurally a new Bitcoin cycle and that Bitcoin will see fresh allocations. When there is a massive monetary debasement event, while both Bitcoin and gold rally, Bitcoin outperforms gold. For example, post-COVID monetary printing, Bitcoin outperformed gold 2.9x over approximately 3.5 years. In fact, even this year, since the banking crisis fears have escalated, Bitcoin rallied approximately 71% year-to-date versus gold rallying approximately 10% year-to-date. In our view, liking gold but not liking Bitcoin is like hating on a faster horse. End quote. The report also identified other catalysts as the continued weakness of US banks and growing concentration in the four biggest banks as exacerbating people's concerns about the centralization of money. The analysts wrote, any potential dislocation, whether on the bank's credit side or on the sovereign side, positions Bitcoin perfectly as a safe haven asset alongside gold. Now, there are a couple other things here that I think are worth noting around this maturing narrative. When Paul Tudor Jones gave his great monetary inflation thesis in 2020, he sort of left out or glossed over or just didn't exactly describe an important concept that left many, even adherents, not exactly understanding what he meant. The narrative that was passed down was Bitcoin as an inflation hedge. But what was meant by inflation was actually fiat currency debasement. This is literally what inflation is, a reduction of the value of dollars or any other fiat. Bitcoin as a fixed supply asset is not a hedge against the inflationary process, as some interpret it, but a hedge against one of the most consequential outcomes of inflation, which is people's money being worth less. I'm glad to see major research houses shift to use the more precise terms of hedge against debasement. The second narrative aspect that I think is vindicating to see start to appear here is the idea of Bitcoin as a hedge against the centralization and control of money. Banks experiencing turmoil driving consolidation in banking certainly reinforces for Bitcoiners the uncontrollable and decentralized nature of the asset. It has seemed like this aspect of Bitcoin has been a lot more recognized following the banking crisis, as this report attests. Now, moving away from price and price narratives, there was some other interesting Bitcoin on-chain data shared by Glassnode this week. The stat that I noticed was around relative distribution by size of holdings. Glassnode has been noticing for a few months now how whales had fewer Bitcoin holdings, but smaller holders have been accumulating more. This week, they looked at shrimp, i.e. folks with less than one Bitcoin. They noted that in the wake of Luna, even as bigger players were scared off, smaller holders increased their absorption. Around the time of the Luna crash, shrimp with less than one Bitcoin per entity held a little under 5% of the Bitcoin supply. They currently hold 6.7% of the overall Bitcoin supply, which means they're holding about 35% more than they did before. In general, I think increasing accumulation among smaller entities is beneficial for Bitcoin decentralization, so I'm enthused to see this happen. It also suggests that even as bigger asset-neutral investors were fleeing, higher conviction retail investors were picking up the slack. And now a quick word from our sponsor. Today's podcast is brought to you by In Wolf's Clothing. Wolf is the first startup accelerator dedicated to Lightning. Four times per year, Wolf brings teams from around the world to New York City to work with like-minded entrepreneurs, pushing the boundaries of what's possible with Bitcoin and Lightning. The program is designed to help early-stage startups achieve product-market fit, develop their brand, secure early-stage funding, and grow businesses that fuel the global adoption of Bitcoin. Learn more or apply at wolfnyc.com. That's wolfnyc.com. And now, back to the show. Next up, let's check in on Bitcoin startups. Bucking current funding trends, Unchained Capital this week announced a $60 million Series B financing round. The round was led by Valor Equity Partners and also included NYDIG, a member of the Stone Ridge family like Bitcoin Builder's exclusive sponsor, Wolf. Unchained has not been unaffected by the crypto bear, having to cut 15% of its team back last November. This raise then is seen as a vote of confidence in the company in what has been an incredibly difficult period. Unchained does a few things. First, they offer a collaborative custody solution where the idea is basically to split a user's Bitcoin between private keys that they hold and private keys that Unchained and other financial service providers hold. The goal is to take advantage of Bitcoin's multi-sig capabilities to give folks the benefit of self-custody, but with some protection from issues like lost or stolen keys. Unchained secures around $2 billion worth of Bitcoin in this way. They also offer Bitcoin collateralized loans, having originated over a half billion of those in the last 5 years, as well as having an IRA offering and a direct OTC desk. One of the Valor partners said, "In the midst of market chaos, Unchained has emerged as a highly trusted provider of Bitcoin custody and financial services through superior technology, risk management, regulatory compliance, and client service." Congrats to Unchained. Glad to see that they're able to keep building. Next, we have an interesting project out of Texas. The company is called My E-Listing, and it hails from near Austin. They've just launched a real estate website akin to Zillow that allows people to list commercial and residential properties for sale, but accepting Bitcoin. The company offers something called an accelerated sale and purchase program, which they say gives sellers the ability to close deals in a single business day. This presumably is meant to take advantage of Bitcoin's rapid settlement, which is of course a hell of a lot faster and more final than the standard real estate escrow process. The company has other industry stalwarts providing infrastructure, with Coinbase Commerce converting buyers' crypto to cash, and Millennial and Championship Title providing title services. Currently, the just-launched site has only a handful of listings. For example, a residential home listed for $500,000 or 17.5 Bitcoin, a $4.3 million commercial property for 150 Bitcoin, or a 40-acre commercial tract in Dallas for 136 Bitcoin. I think it's a pretty high-potential approach, so we'll be watching this closely. A couple updates now in the world of Lightning. On Monday, April 17th, Michael Saylor tweeted, "So MicroStrategy converted my corporate email address into a Lightning address, and people keep sending me 21 sats." What does this mean? Well, on the surface level, that anyone can use Saylor at microstrategy.com to send Michael Saylor Bitcoin. So was he just out trying to score some extra sats? Nah, probably not. In fact, this year has been very good to MicroStrategy. The current cost basis for their 140,000-ish Bitcoin is $29,803, which meant that for most of the last couple of weeks, they were actually in the black until this recent dip. I also don't think that the conversion is just about the internal convenience of MicroStrategy employees sending each other Bitcoin. My guess is that it's an attempt, a little one, no doubt, to show how easy and convenient the Lightning Network is getting. If you look at the responses to the post and the quote tweets, a ton of them are some form of, whoa, you can send Bitcoin on Lightning with just an email address? Now, another step in normalizing Lightning is exchange integration. It is basically guaranteed right now that anytime the CEO of an exchange that hasn't enabled Lightning tweets about anything, someone is going to reply guy with a question about when they will enable Lightning. Earlier this month, Bitcoiner Wicked tweeted a search and said, "It's weird how Brian Armstrong is actively ignoring the Bitcoin Lightning Network. He hasn't ever tweeted about it, not even once." Maybe surprisingly, Brian responded, saying, "My tweets auto-delete after some number of months, so there is no search history. Lightning is great and something will integrate." This was the beginning, middle, and end of the story, but you better believe that that has now been screenshot about 10,000 times, and those are all waiting to be shared back at Brian if he and Coinbase don't follow through. Now, before we come to our last segment, I want to pause here to ask for some feedback. One of the things I want to do with this weekly breakdown on builders is to be the single most info jam-packed 15 to 20 minutes of the week that was Bitcoin. So what do you want to hear on it? Is this format, which is pretty similar to the main breakdown show, but maybe a little bit more newsy, fine? Are there things you want more of here? Are there segments that feel really important to you? Subcategories of Bitcoin that you want to make sure I check in on each week? If so, please go check out the Breakers Discord. You can find it at bit.ly/breakdownpod. We have a channel just for Bitcoin builders, as well as lots of other channels, and I would love to hear from you. But with that, let's turn to an update on mining, both practically and in terms of narrative, which will get us also to the note that we'll end on, which is Bitcoin and political intrigue. Last week on the show, I told you all about the right to mine bills that were floating around through a number of state legislatures, including a couple that had been passed and were just waiting for their respective governor's signatures. This was the result of a lot of hard work of many different advocacy groups led at the center by the Satoshi Action Fund. And on April 18th, Bitcoin mining advocates had a breakthrough when the state of Arkansas became the first state to officially pass one of these right-to-mine legislations, House Bill 1799. Now, of course, that hasn't been the only discussion about Bitcoin mining recently. For months, there had been rumors of a New York Times hit piece coming for the space. About a week and a half ago, it finally dropped, and frankly, it was weird. It was a bit of a tortured argument that tried to extract out lessons from one situation in Texas to all states, with the issue being that even in the context of Texas, it wasn't really like the article was making it out to be. The piece looked at the events surrounding the 2021 Texas winter storm, which shut down the power grid and led to the deaths of almost 40 people. The closest thing to a smoking gun the articles could find in that case was that Bitcoin mines continued to operate until midnight on the night the grid was overloaded, when miners were ordered to shut down by the grid operator under the terms of a demand response program. The article then accused miner Bitdeer from profiteering from the crisis, taking $18 million in compensation payments over the following 4 days. Now, what's important to note for you intrepid observers is that Bitdeer was compensated based on a program that many, many other industries and companies also have access to in Texas. It's not like they held the local grid operator ERCOT hostage and demanded $18 million. As Level 39 put it, the craziest thing about the New York Times anti-Bitcoin mining article is that the author spent 6 months figuring out how to tell readers that demand response programs, enthusiastically endorsed by the U.S. Department of Energy and previously the New York Times, is bad? Going on, the article seems to single out Bitcoin miners for being really good at participating in these programs. Now, of course, one would think that Bitcoin miners, as a flexible energy consumer that can literally turn on and off with the flip of a switch, makes them hugely appealing as part of that sort of demand response system. Other claims that the article makes include the idea that mining facilities push up the cost of electricity for the surrounding region and contribute to increased use of marginal gas-powered plants, which increase carbon emissions for the grid. According to energy research firm Wood Mackenzie, this additional electricity costs amount to a nearly 5% increase in Texas, where the mining industry is most concentrated. However, the article gave no methodology for this, and as we'll see in just a minute, seems to have dramatically overestimated, well, a lot, and cherry-picked data in other situations. Just to give a taste for how bad faith this piece was overall, here's an excerpt from its conclusion. In Rockdale, where two of the largest mines in the country operate just outside the city limits, the city manager Barbara Hawley told the Times that the town used to be a fairly wealthy little community. She said that changed when a large industrial plant that had provided thousands of jobs closed more than a decade ago. It just cut the legs out from under this community, she said. It was the old aluminum smelter, now home to the Bit Deer mine. As if the mining industry showing up in town had anything to do with an aluminum smelter shutting down a decade earlier. And just to rub this in, a nice denouement came on this when, as an anti-Texas mining bill, the one that we discussed last week, started circulating, the Rockdale City Council, in other words, the city council of the town this piece tried to use with its bully cudgel, voted unanimously to condemn that anti-mining action. Now, there are so many critiques and rebuttals. One that I will point to is environmental analyst Daniel Batten, who said that the emissions levels are overstated by an average of 81.7% for each of the miners mentioned in this piece. But overall, I think I don't need to get too deep into this, as I'm sure you've seen it and been part of the discussions. What I thought was notable, and that is worth talking about, is how unbelievably little traction this piece got. It just didn't become a talking point for other critics. This is the type of piece that in the past would have had a legion of talking heads regurgitating it ad nauseum. It sort of reminds me of how the Greenpeace anti-Bitcoin campaign funded by Ripple's Chris Larson has just had less than no traction. It seems to present evidence that the Bitcoin mining and environmental FUD narrative either A, just doesn't have the juice it once did, and or B, just can't really hold up to much scrutiny. I think there's just too much counter-information out there, and frankly, too many environmentalists on Team Orange now. Of course, that doesn't mean I think the battle is over. Just listen to last week where we talked about the specific legislation in Texas that's being seen as an attack on Bitcoin mining. What's clear, though, is that this sort of environmental FUD does not have the drop-the-mic sort of resonance it once did. Which brings me to our last topic for today, and a narrative which very much could raise some hackles in the US, especially among the policy crowd. There has been a loud and growing conversation about de-dollarization around the world. And importantly, it's no longer just for Bitcoin Twitter. I mean, Tucker Carlson had Luke Grumman on to talk about why foreign central banks are abandoning US treasuries, for goodness sake. Now, that said, there's been far more narrative than evidence, but one highly noticeable story this week came from Russia. On Monday, Russian news agency TASS reported news from the head of the Bank of Russia, who said that that agency was working on a, quote, experimental legal regime for Bitcoin and crypto to be used in export-import deals. As part of this, the country plans to mine Bitcoin to be used in this cross-border settlement. In fact, the bank is planning on creating special organizations for exactly this purpose. This is obviously and explicitly in response to U.S. sanctions against Russia, following their invasion of Ukraine. Those sanctions, whatever effect they've had on the war, have also had the unintended consequence of making every other sovereign in the world more wary of their dollar reliance. For many, many years, the US's control of the dollar system was kind of benign and hands-off. It allowed markets to use dollars more or less as they would. The more the US politicizes the dollar, however, the more of a liability it becomes. And that's the case even if the US is in some moral right to politicize the dollar. The question then is what happens if Russia starts actively engaging in large-scale foreign trade using Bitcoin as a settlement currency? Will the US take that as another justification to crack down, this time turning Sauron's eye to Bitcoin itself? Will other global sovereigns see the example and start to explore Bitcoin as a settlement currency alternative for their own trade? Will both of these things happen all at once? That remains to be seen, but we are clearly entering a whole new era, and fascinatingly, the presence of Bitcoin on the scene has transformational implications for the realignment happening. Heady stuff to close this show. Listen, I want to thank my sponsor In Wolf's Clothing once again, the Wolf Lightning Accelerator, for supporting the show. Go check them out at wolfnyc.com. Think about applying to an upcoming cohort they have. They are awesome and they make this show possible. For all of you guys who are listening, it's been another great week in Bitcoin. But until next time, let's build.